Worldwide Alumni Celebration is the annual celebration of London Business School's incredible network of 44,000 international alumni, connecting our community of diverse minds all around the globe. At the 2019 event in London, Hélène Rey, Lord Bagri Professor of Economics at London Business School, led a panel discussion on the consequences of Brexit for the British economy and business leaders.
So we are fantastically lucky to have tonight with us, so on my left, Rory Stewart, who is Member of Parliament since 2010. We've had several ministerial appointments, many very distinguished awards. He has been trekking in Afghanistan, he's been very concerned about the Turquoise Mountain. He has written many books and been a professor of the practice of human rights at the Harvard Kennedy School. And in any case, anyone paying just even a tiny bit of attention to UK politics will know Rory very well. To the left is Dale Murray, who is an alum. She has a very distinguished career in entrepreneurship, in the tech sector in particular. And she has also served on the task force of David Cameron on red tape of the EU in 2013. She was a British Angel Investor of the Year in 2011. And she's a partner in Founders Intelligence, which is a digital strategy consultancy. She's also on the board of several leading companies. And to the very left there, Sébastien Malaby, who is a senior fellow for international economics at the Council of Foreign Relations, and is also a columnist for the Washington Post and author of several great books, including recently one on Alan Greenspan, which won the Financial Times and McKinsey Business Book of the Year Award in 2016. So with that, I think we should crack it tonight. But since I am a professor of international macroeconomics, we are going to start by watching a few charts of data. So this first chart shows you the dollar sterling exchange rate. And when it goes down, it means the sterling goes down. As you can see, the referendum there in June 2016, that's the cliff, when it goes down really quickly. And then we have had a little bit of recovery, and then again, we have been on the downside for a while now. The next graph is about growth. And here we are comparing the growth performance in the recent years of the UK, the US, and the euro area in real GDP. And you can see, so the UK is actually the dark blue bar. You can see that in the recent years, the UK has underperformed both the euro area and the United States. Now, why is that? So one clear possibility of what is happening and to explain the macroeconomy is the level of uncertainty that has been inflicted upon the economy because of the whole Brexit process. And to back up this plausible hypothesis, we have some actually academic work which just came out with a survey of UK firms, where UK firms have been asked whether Brexit makes it in their top uncertainty concerns. And here we can see that in the recent period, about 60% almost of UK firms put Brexit as a very important factor of concern in terms of uncertainty. And this has increased in the recent period. Now, this is the microdata based on survey, but how does that translate into the macroeconomic realm? Well, we can see that here, when firms are more uncertain, they don't invest as much. And on this chart, you have a comparison of the UK investment over time, which has been tracking the G7 investment up to a point, which is roughly the referendum, after which you see this gap opening, and you see that investment in the UK has actually slowed down quite noticeably compared to the other G7 economy. So that's a macro manifestation of the uncertainty that we've seen in survey data in the previous slides. Finally, so we saw that in the investment slide, the Brexit date had an effect on investment, but we also see it in migration. So if we look at international migration, EU versus non-EU, we see that the migrants from the EU have tended to go down. The number of migrants have gone down quite a bit from the date of the referendum, which is the dotted line, whereas the non-EU migrants have gone up, but not one for one, so that there's a total decrease in the number of migrants. Now, these are the macro data, but we have also asked you to answer a couple of questions, and we know you are not a representative sample. However, it was still important to know what you thought about the Brexit process and whether you have, you know, any major decision in your business that you have delayed or changed because of the process of Brexit. And here is the answer. Quite overwhelmingly, yes, 56% of you have changed a decision because of Brexit, a major one. And what is that decision? Well, a lot of you, it's about investment. So we can see here in the survey data, in a way, what we saw in the macro data as well. It kind of fits together. But also a quarter of you answered decision about hiring, okay, which is also a very important thing that one can be delayed when there is a lot of uncertainty. Now, the question two was about your private life. What about the effect of Brexit on your private life, not only on the business? And there, so interestingly, you've not been affected as much because only 36% said yes. And in which realm have you been affected? Well, again, investment. So here I suspect there's a lot of real estate decisions and housing decision, but also passport, okay? While consumption behavior has not been affected that much. Very good. So now that we have seen all these data, both macro and survey, we are going to go to our panel and both comment on these issues and also, of course, broaden very much the topic of the discussion. So maybe let us start with you, Sebastian, the other end. So you've seen all these, you know, these graphs about uncertainty going up, both in survey data and in macro data. You've seen the path of sterling. So what kind of comment can you make on this? I mean, what does that tell you?
I'll try two comments, you know, one a bit lighthearted and one a bit more serious. On the lighthearted side, you know, you had the slide about whether it affects your personal life. I'm told that 37% of Remainers in one survey said that they would be upset if a member of their family married somebody who was a leaver. So actually, this is kind of infiltrating into people's romantic lives. And I've also seen stuff about marriage counselors saying that in breakups in the last couple of years, disagreements over Brexit have actually been one of the causes. And so it is something where, and we'll probably get to this later, but, you know, the incredible thing is that some significant chunk of Britain didn't really have a view one way or the other on the EU until after the vote. 4 out of 10 or something took their position after the vote. But once the sides dug in, people adopted tribal identities on either side in a very, very intense way, such that although only, I think, half of Britons say they have a clear view on which religion they identify with, 87% have a clear view on whether they are Remain or Leave. So that's just one thought on the personal thing. It is actually getting to people in a visceral way. But more seriously, I'd make a quick comment, perhaps a sort of risky one, on the currency chart that you put up, because I'm struck, frankly, by how firm sterling is. I would have expected it to be weaker. And the reason I say this is that a few years back, I wrote a history of hedge fund trading. And this one of the sort of central ideas I got from talking to macro traders who do currencies and kind of big macro trends is the idea of asymmetric bets. So any of you in the markets are familiar with this, but the notion is you could have something where it could go one way, it could go the other way, you think it's kind of a 50-50, but the implications of a move in one direction could be 5x or 3x how much it would move in the opposite direction. And sterling feels to me like that right now, because in some sense, if you imagine the best possible outcome from where we are today with Brexit, where, you know, somehow Boris Johnson gets this revised deal both through Brussels and through Parliament, in my view that would be a miracle, but let's just suppose that he managed that, which would be kind of, I think, the softest landing that any of us could posit. And what should that be implying for sterling? Well, under Theresa May, sterling bounced around between 133 and 126 to the dollar. The Johnson deal would be a harder Brexit than the May withdrawal deal. So I think that implies that 126 would be as strong as sterling should be. It should probably be 125. It's at 123 now, right? So if you bet short sterling, The most you could lose would be a couple of points from 1.23 today back to about 1.25, 1.26. But if we had a crash out, it could go, I would say, at least 10 or 15 points the other way. So I'm thinking it's an asymmetric bet. I've tried this on various friends in the markets. I'm not quite sure why sterling isn't weaker than it is.
Well, but if we do crash out, and if we lose this, 10 to 15 points, which seem realistic to me, so that's going to put also the Bank of England in a difficult situation, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one thing people perhaps underweight is that, you know, there was so-called Project Fear before the 2016 referendum. People projected that there would be a big problem for the economy, and there wasn't. Well, why wasn't there? Basically, three reasons. The world economy was pretty strong. Monetary policy was supportive because the Bank of England cut rates, and the exchange rate corrected immediately, which provided a macro boost to the UK economy. So the reason, I mean, your charts show that investment has suffered, but there wasn't an immediate growth or employment effect straight away because of those three factors. Now, could the Bank of England repeat that rescue act? I don't think so. And the reason is that, you know, inflation is already a bit above target. You've already got a situation where the weak currency means you're importing some inflation. If the currency weakened more with a crash out, the Bank of England would be in a box. So I agree that Project Fear, so-called, was overhyped. I fear that next time round, it may not be wrong to believe in fear.
Thank you, Sebastian. So Dale, from where you stand in your business, so do you see all this cost playing out in the same way, or do you see different things in terms of cost and benefits of the Brexit process?
I think the answer is that it very much depends on the business. So I work predominantly with technology companies and predominantly in the software sector. So what these types of companies need is they need capital, they need money from venture capitalists often, and they need access to talent, they need people. So on the first point, venture capital is still widely available. For a good business, you should be able to raise funds to build your business. There was initially some perception that access to talent would be limited after the referendum, but I don't think that's played out badly. What has happened is the government continues to offer visas, so there are ways in which talented migrants can come from other countries and still come into this country and operate in the tech sector. In the world of entrepreneurship, of course, entrepreneurs are pretty good at adjusting to their environment. So I think with the referendum, absolutely a bit of a shock, but then they found they can still get capital, they can still get people, and what they do is adjust their business to where the opportunity is. Now that it has gone on a little bit longer than anybody envisaged or hoped, I think the investment that we see on your chart, we see that prolonged period of delayed or investment or no choice has been made, that's beginning to have a little bit of a drag, I think, on all businesses now that I see. They're tired, obviously, they're exhausted. They are finding that if they've got very large corporates that they're selling to, decisions are not being taken now. That's really happened, I think, in the last 3 to 6 months. Everything is beginning, my sense is beginning to seize up. So that means, of course, that more people won't get hired, which means that the government's tax receipts will lower and you won't get the job creation, you won't get the innovation. But generally, actually, it's more of an optimistic view because entrepreneurs, as I say, they'll just spin towards the best opportunity.
So in terms of hiring talent in your industries, how much do you say about your reliance on the EU workers? So for example, we have seen that in the NHS, if we look at nurses and doctors, there has been a drop in EU nurses and doctors coming into the NHS and with a difficulty to hire. Do you see anything similar?
I think we see a different thing, actually. I think we see in the tech sector, we rely on engineers, of course, and we see actually that we don't have enough engineers in England. And so what is often happening is that we're putting pods of engineers or buying pods or squads in places like Portugal, Hungary, Romania, lots of the Eastern European states, Georgia, all sorts of countries like that. So those universities, actually, they're the further education and higher education systems over there have been exceptional at cultivating great swathes of talented engineers. And so what we're finding is that the IP and the ideas and the design is being created and held here and controlled here where the capital is in London, but then they're going out to place the talent in those other countries.
Thank you very much. So now we turn to Rory. And Rory, I mean, I think it's pretty clear there's There is a lot of uncertainty. One could say even maybe chaotic behavior in the political class right now with Brexit. So we are all wondering whether you could throw some light for us and put a bit of structure on this chaos.
So there is, of course, I mean, there's terrible behavior amongst the political class. But to some extent, of course, the political class reflects very much what the members of parliament feel on the doorsteps. In other words, they are trying to hold their seats, they're trying to respond to their constituents. And therefore, the hysterical behaviour in parliament is, to some extent, simply an exaggerated version of the hysterical behaviour that Sebastian's pointed to in the public at large. The fundamental problem, really, underlying Brexit, I think if you were to look back in 50 or 100 years' time, is the refusal of the people who voted Remain. I voted Remain, right? But the refusal of the people who voted Remain in the immediate aftermath of the referendum to accept the result or try to compromise on any form of soft Brexit, which has effectively meant that within the House of Commons, it has been completely impossible to generate a majority for anything. If we end up now with this new deal that Boris is proposing, I agree with Sebastian, it's very unlikely, or we end up with a no deal. One of the reasons for that is the refusal of people who were committed to Remain, their refusal to vote for Theresa May's deal. So ultimately, there were nearly 92% of Conservative MPs voted for Theresa May's deal, but Labour, that initially claimed that they were in favour of some form of soft Brexit, ultimately found themselves unable to compromise in any way and vote for it in any way. And I think this is an uncomfortable message for those of us who voted Remain, because we tend to feel very good about ourselves, we tend to feel very smug, we tend to, particularly if we're economists, feel that we have all the economic data on our side. But fundamentally, the only way in which this is ever, ever, ever going to be resolved is by people compromising. And it is this refusal to compromise in a vote that was very close to begin with that has stuffed us in this predicament, and the members of parliament are simply responding to that.
So how do you explain this turn to populism that we see, you know, in the UK, that we've seen in the US, and what can we do? I mean, in terms of, you know, us business or economists, is there anything we can contribute to turn back to normal politics?
So populism is not inevitable. Populism, I think, is a choice. It's a choice that becomes easier in a world of social media. So it's a choice that becomes easier when you can create these weird little communities of people who agree with you, and that allows you to generate your Arab Spring or generate your Donald Trump or generate your Brexit Party rage. It becomes easier, but it's not inevitable. And it is generally a choice of leaders. So there are two ways of looking at the story which I've just told. It's true that the public is deeply, deeply divided. But it is possible for politicians in a divided society to choose to take the risk of compromise. Obviously, famously, Nelson Mandela was under an enormous amount of pressure not to compromise. In Northern Ireland, as we approached the Good Friday Agreement, there would be many people who would have been under huge pressure to say, just stick with your base, what can you gain from compromise? And the problem within British politics at the moment is that people haven't had the courage to reach across, right? That is a failure of courage by Brexit politicians to reach towards the Remainers, and a failure of courage of the Remain politicians to reach towards the Brexiteers. What can businesses do about this? Well, I think in a way, businesses have also been slightly to blame. I mean, casting blame around in the world of Brexit is a dangerous thing to do, because the fundamental people to blame are the politicians. But I was struck by the fact that when the Brexit vote happened, there was not quite as much constructive suggestions coming forward from business on the shape of a soft Brexit. In the United States, I think you would have seen businesses and other institutions, the Brookings Institution, the Council on Foreign Relations, the universities, generating a lot of models of soft Brexits which people could debate. Instead of which, in this country, almost from the moment of the result, there was a surprising reluctance. Until quite recently, actually, the National Farmers Union has only really come out with powerful stuff against the no-deal Brexit. About 3 weeks ago, the CBI has only really come out against the no-deal Brexit about 5-6 weeks ago. If they had got into this debate 2.5 years ago, we're against the no-deal Brexit, but we're in favour of a soft Brexit, I think it would have been much easier to win that public debate. But there was simply nothing really going on actually in the media to make constructive voices for compromise, and business is part of that story.
I think that's an interesting point that Rory makes, because when you have this tribalism that has been created, we have these two tribes in politics, we have these two tribes now in society, and they are very, very separate. Business, I think, has always struggled to find constructive and positive ways to engage with politics. It used to be a lot better, and now it finds itself a little bit lost. I used to serve on the board at the Department for Business, and I used to be on David Cameron's Business Task Force, and I was always struck in working on the periphery of Whitehall how exceptional the civil service and the political talent was. But they don't and they can't operate in a vacuum. They must operate with the good ideas and good perspectives from the business community and the, you know, the third sector and other parts of our community at large. And I was always struck that so often business people found it very difficult to engage with their politicians or didn't know quite how to, or perhaps they brought problems rather than bringing solutions. And if you're good in business, you find solutions. So as a nation, we need to find ways back to that model where business can constructively and positively help to bring solutions to the table and work with our politicians and indeed our civil servants.
Very wise word. Sebastian, do you agree? Yeah.
So you asked the question originally in the context of populism worldwide and how should business respond not just to Brexit but to that. I'm struck in America by the following. There's been a remarkable shift. The business roundtable, which is sort of the top CEOs, kind of declared that the role of the company was not actually simply to increase shareholder value, but was to serve multiple stakeholders. And that was, I think, about a month or so ago when that came out. And when we've been hearing a lot about this kind of thing from the sort of environmental, social impact stuff that boards care about to various other ways of signaling to millennial recruits that, you know, you're good guys and so on. And I think that's been a very striking shift, but what hasn't gone with it is a sort of public policy shift where business has responded to the fact that even amongst Republicans in the US, something like 40% tell the Pew Research Center that companies should pay more tax. And the fact that you've got this kind of cross-border tax shifting, which is made obviously so easy by decisions about you can choose where to locate your IP legally and all that stuff. I think that is something which stores up a lot of anger for business, against business. And so this is this disparity between a huge amount of action and redefining the purpose of the company vis-a-vis stakeholders, but not much action on this issue of public policy.
Can I just come into this? I mean, it is rather a sort of interesting question why businesses in the UK were so slow to really define the Brexit debate. So it's partly, I think, lack of knowledge of how to engage with politicians, but there was also a few. So it's sort of rather odd that they didn't get involved more in public communication. I mean, famously, we're all supposed to believe that the tobacco companies in the 1980s were great masters in trying to shift public opinion in their economic interests. So you would have imagined that if you were the automobile sector in Britain or the agricultural sector, you would have really gone out there to sell a customs union and find ways of focus grouping the public, advertising to the public, shifting, getting onto social media, rather than allowing what happened, which is in the end, 17 million people who had no idea what a customs union was being convinced within about a week that a customs union was the worst thing in the world.
Right.
And I don't know why that is. I mean, what is it about businesses that make them reluctant to do that? Is it partly, and this is something I was just thinking on the stage, I mean, is it partly that a great number of these companies are actually multinational companies that don't really have their most senior people in the United Kingdom, and therefore they don't really have the leadership to make the very bold and difficult decisions to seize a very unusual political moment and really throw themselves behind doing things in a very different way, either to shift the key politicians or shift the public?
I don't think they saw that this was their business. This was a political debate that was happening leading up to the referendum. It was a question posed by politicians to the electorate. And I don't think they saw that it was their business. And also, business works on the strengths of people, and I think they got the sense very quickly that they could alienate potentially half their workforce if they went very strongly one way or the other, half their supply chain, half their customers. In business, that's not how we think. We think about making great products and producing terrific services in order to create value and create jobs and sell at a profit and have some commercial advantage and be sustainable, but we're not thinking about necessarily whether or not we should sit within or outside of that union. So I don't disagree that it would definitely could have been useful for more debate to be had. But I think it's a very difficult thing for a CEO to get out there and make such bold statements.
It's very interesting, because I would have thought, I mean, insofar as Brexit represents a very significant threat to the automobile sector, right, I would have imagined that Nissan and others would have put an enormous amount of energy and money behind think tanks, behind people generating soft Brexit proposals, behind lobbying groups, behind PR companies, behind community, because it is a fundamental threat to their entire business model. And obviously, very, very belatedly in the last few weeks, a little bit of that stuff has begun to emerge. But
this is, we have to remember, a very radical experiment in deglobalization. I mean, I can't think of another case where you don't just merely fail to do a new trade deal, you actually take, you know, 30 or 40 years of past deals and say, well, now I want to extract myself. And that's very hard both for the civil service to get its mind around, and hence the Brexit planning took a long time to get off the ground. It froze the civil service, it froze the political leadership, and it froze business. Everybody was frozen by this. And, you know, I think if you look at the way that consumer spending in the UK initially went up, there was this sort of reaction that, well, we're not going to save for this because it's so unfathomable that, hey, we'll just go out and spend. And I think the human mind is just not very good at grappling with the unknown unknown, something you haven't experienced before.
Well, you have to give it to the academic economists that 95% of the profession was pretty much united in giving a message on the problems of Brexit. And true, I mean, forecast in macroeconomics, you can never get it spot on, and the timing is always going to be a bit wrong. But the basic mechanism was there and explained. But more or less, the experts were shut off of the debate because there was a rejection.
But let me come back on this, because I think this is to disagree with my chair for a second. Look, you're focusing on pointing out the problems. What was lacking was you producing really exciting, constructive solutions, proposing what would have been a better soft Brexit. That's what was entirely lacking in this. There's any number of people pointing out that people perhaps should not have voted to leave the European Union, right? But it's not very useful when people have already made that decision. What would have been helpful is you shaping the debate about what a really good soft Brexit would look like.
But so, Rory, we had a number of menu items on there, like, you know, the Norway, Switzerland, Canada, plus Canada, plus, plus. So there were all kind of things that had already been explored, more or less, by trade economists. And in some sense, I mean, it didn't get really through to the public debate, maybe because, indeed, these are really complicated matters. And as we know, just after the Brexit referendum, there was sudden realization that a lot of people didn't really know what the single market was, what a custom union was, what all these things were. And it was just too sudden, in a way, for the public to absorb all that. So the communication was really broken.
Can't think of a really powerful, exciting product from academics or public intellectuals proposing Switzerland or Norway or Turkey. There didn't seem to me that I can think of any of your colleagues who produced the great bestseller saying, this is the solution, this is where we're going to go. What I noticed was everybody pointing out the problems, why you should never have left in the first place.
Trade economists are too boring, what can I say? But so if we want to build on what you have said and what also Dale and Sebastian said about what the UK could look like, I mean, if we in the case of Brexit, so if we try to look forward and ask ourselves, so will the UK transform itself into the famous mythical Singapore on Thames? You mentioned, you know, the issue of tax paying. So are we going towards low tax jurisdictions? Are we going towards a lightly regulated jurisdiction? And Dale, that's important in your business also for what's going to happen with data, for example. How is the UK going to deal with, you know, GDPR in the EU and then some other thing in China, some other thing in the US? So which way is it going to go? I mean, how are we seeing the future from that point of view? Is there any?
I see zero evidence that the UK political system is moving in a free market direction. I mean, zero. Obviously, the Labour Party is moving to the left, and the Conservative Party, both under Theresa May and under Boris Johnson, is more in a sort of one-nation centrist sort of let's help the just about managing. And that was Theresa May's pitch, and that's now Boris Johnson's with his public spending spree. You know, it's an appeal to the centre. The country is not of a mind to deliver some sort of Singapore on Thames. It's just, I kind of discount that. I think the kind of more interesting question to ask about the future of the British economy is, are the core strengths, which I would list as remarkable openness to immigration and immigrant talent, which you see in the academic sector, Hélène, you see it in the business sector, you see it also even in the government sector, Mark Carney being a prominent example, but by no means the only one, that this country just hoovers up talent from all over the place. It's an incredible strength. Will that be preserved, is one question. Second kind of strength is sort of the rule of law and respect for property rights, which makes it a great place for investment. Will that be preserved? And then I think a sort of social cohesion and a kind of trust in the civil service, a trust that this is basically a decent place with enough, which makes it a kind of stable and functioning social democracy. And I think, you know, you can ask questions about all of these things. I would quickly say that, you know, on migration, it's been nice to see that attitudes towards immigrants in polling have kind of snapped back. There was a low around the referendum in 2016 because there'd been a surge of inward migration. The timing of the referendum was unfortunate from a Remain perspective in that sense. And now I think that surveys are showing that tolerance of immigrants is kind of back to where it used to be. Equally, there was a surge of anti-immigrant or racial violence in the 6 months or 12 months after the referendum. Now that's gone back to trend. So those things have gone back to a good place, which is great. On the rule of law, I mean, you can construct a pessimistic story that when you have a prime minister who says that all 11 justices who rule against him on the prorogation issue, all of them, like it was an 11-0, I think, decision, that all 11 were wrong. I mean, that doesn't encourage respect for the courts, I don't think. When he says that he will not ask for an extension, notwithstanding a law that requires him to do so, it's not great for the rule of law either. But I do kind of see these as sort of extreme things that are going on because of the Brexit politics, and that probably will snap back to normal. I think on the sort of social glue, that's where perhaps one might be most worried, that this really has been an experience over 3 years that has kind of started to undo some of the binding glue between Scotland and England, which was already frayed, between the metropolis and the rural areas of Britain, between the young and the old. These cleavages have very much been exposed, and you do wonder if it's possible to put that genie back into the bottle.
Yes. So, Dale, what do you think about this, you know, vision for the future of Britain? Something light regulation? How do you see the relation also with the Commonwealth, the US?
Well, look,
versus the EU?
I'll tell you what I think I'd like to happen. Nobody knows what will happen. I went to Brussels with David Cameron and I met people like Angela Merkel, and with my colleagues proposed a number of measures to reduce business bureaucracy, many of which, this was in 2013, 2014, many of which the EU moved on. Nonetheless, it was insufficient with everything else that David Cameron did to persuade the electorate to stay. So we are where we are. Now, I sit on boards around the world, and I attend board meetings in San Francisco and in Sydney and in Auckland, and there is a great big world out there. And we, as a country, have lost our optimism at the moment. And when I go out of the country and go out and do business, they are very optimistic. You know, things are looking good in the rest of the world. I was born and raised in New Zealand, which is a tiny country of only 5 million people. But In the 1970s, when Britain first joined the common market, New Zealand, which is a primary produce country, or at least it was then, apples, pears, sheep, milk, you know, lamb, butter, it had lost its export market. It lost Britain as the place where it could send all of its products to. So the economy was very shocked and it retracted, and there was a huge period of change in that country. But then they moved towards free market policies and became importantly, critically, very, very outward looking. New Zealand in 2008 was the first developed country to sign a free trade agreement with China. And now its biggest trading partner in goods is China. Now, you can imagine for a small country like New Zealand, which is geographically closer to China than it is to the motherland of Great Britain, how impactful that free trade agreement was. So that tiny country had an optimistic outlook. They looked at what they could do really well. They looked at the market of the world and decided to position their advantages towards those markets that wanted them. I really, really hope that our leadership in this country, that our business, that our politicians can get behind this idea and reshape Britain to look beyond Europe, because it's a very big world out there. We do so much that is brilliant in Britain, and we will continue to do so. And let's just make sure that the rest of the world can trade in the great stuff that we do.
A boring trade economist would say, geography matters.
Geography matters, yes.
Well, New Zealand's not that close to China. It's really not that close at all.
It's closer than Britain.
Yeah. But her implication is that Britain is too far from these places to trade.
No, I agree. Yeah. Britain is not too far to trade, no, absolutely.
No. So, I mean, I think there's a number of things going on. I mean, one of them, just to sort of a footnote on Sebastian to challenge him not to do this again. Boris Johnson is not a one-nation conservative. That is a tradition of, well, it's effectively a socially liberal, inclusive, non-divisive type of conservatism. He's a populist who spends a lot of money. Spending a lot of money is not a sign that you're a centrist. It's a sign that you, effectively, he does not believe in fiscal discipline. He wants to write big checks. But that isn't one-nation conservatism. And I don't allow him to claim to be a one-nation conservative. There's no evidence that he's a one-nation conservative except that he writes big checks.
Duly noted.
In fact, actually, almost every one-nation, self-proclaimed one-nation conservative in the party, he's thrown out. I mean, he's just chucked out the 22 core members of the one-nation conservatives. And the reason he threw us out is that it's not just the disagreement about Brexit. It's an entire disagreement about the type of party the Conservative Party is. He's shifting his entire electoral strategy around to a Trumpian base. He's chasing these votes up in the Northeast. This isn't a one-nation strategy at all. It's the reverse. It's a Trumpian strategy. However, there is a question going beyond Boris about what could happen after the European Union for Britain. And one of those questions is, of course, about whether Britain would wish to make significant supply-side reforms. Is it interested in significant deregulation? Does it want to return to those kinds of debates in the 1980s? It would have the possibility of doing more of that if it went down the route of no longer participating in the single market than it would when it remained in the European Union. At the moment, as Sebastian says, it doesn't feel as though there's much public will for that. The general instinct is the government's just going to end up spending more and more money, and indeed possibly spending money, it's just going to lift straight from the Bank of England and push out the door. But my suspicion is that that is not an inevitable, ineluctable trend, and that one of the things that, of course, drove most of the most ardent Brexiteers is that they're real fiscal hawks, very, very interested in supply-side reforms, and they will begin pushing back hard within the Conservative Party in that direction. Whether they can get anywhere remains to be seen.
And could you say just a word maybe about the type of partnership with the United States?
Type of partnership with the United States? Well, I think that's going to be very difficult if we're talking about a free trade agreement. I don't think that Donald Trump is famous for an America last policy. I don't think he's famous for his win-win generous negotiations. And I think if Britain is in a position of weakness outside the European Union, it will be very difficult. Not least because even if there's actually if I'm not being flippant for a second, even with goodwill from the president, the US bureaucracy that does trade negotiations is famously hard-nosed and tough, and then you've got to stick Congress into the picture, all of which makes me think that it's unlikely that there are going to be significant advantages to Britain.
And nor is it the case that President Elizabeth Warren would be altogether more favourable towards a free trade deal.
Probably not.
No.
Just a quick round. So we also asked people at which date they thought essentially the UK would get out of the EU. So I'm going to ask you the same question. What is your best forecast? Sebastian.
April the 30th, 2020.
Okay.
I've got no idea. I mean,
that's a valid answer.
Am I supposed to provide the logic, or
we're just aggregating wisdom at this stage. So.
Yeah, no, there's no wisdom here.
But if you have a strong logic for April, you may want.
No, I'm just thinking that the extension from the end of October goes to the end of January, and we'll get that. After that, maybe another 3 months, and that, you know, either Boris will have crashed us out, or negotiated us out, or if we're still in a hung parliament post-election, I suspect that the French in particular will get fed up with waiting, and in a way that does not leave their fingerprints on our backs, it will be pushed out of the door.
Rory?
I have simply no idea at all. My ex-colleague George Osborne's theory is that we're never going to leave, that it's going to become a sort of ritual that every year people will come and sort of say, you know, we seek an extension. It's going to be in 150 years' time, some man in a strange frock coat will come and say, we seek an extension, like this. And all the members of Parliament will go, hear, hear. And they'll go to the European Union and nothing will happen. But no, I...
Well, Turkey negotiated forever about joining and never joined.
Right.
We can negotiate forever about leaving and never leave, as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems fair. So let's see what actually people thought here. So the question was, you know, will the UK be out of the EU, etc., a bunch of dates. And, okay, so beliefs are pretty widespread, but relatively few people think it's going to be the 31st of October. However, most people think the UK will leave, but a quarter think never. So I'm not sure we are a lot wiser now. I would just like to thank very much the panelists, because I thought that was extraordinarily thoughtful and interesting. I certainly got a lot out of what you said. So thank you so much.
This was a London Business School podcast, bringing you fresh insights and ideas from London Business School's experts. To listen and read more, visit www.london.edu.